This is an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
You join me here on RNIB Connect Radio with actor, producer, novelist and writer Julian Fellowes, who has been a long-time supporter of the RNIB and is also one of our vice presidents. Julian has just kindly recorded a version of the poem The Night Before Christmas for us here at the RNIB for our RNIB Talking Books Library. Julian, welcome to RNIB Connect Radio, and thank you very much indeed for recording A Night Before Christmas for us here at the RNIB. Was The Night Before Christmas something that you remember from your sort of childhood and things like that, and something that you've read or remember hearing?
I've always liked the poem, and I think it sort of crept up on me, rather. I remember seeing a film with Joan Crawford and her children, which of course is quite a contentious area anyway, and they were doing The Night Before Christmas. So it sort of stuck in my mind after seeing that. But I like it. I like its Americanness. I like the fact that it is part of an American Christmas as much as anything else. And so I was rather pleased at the idea of reading it in these spanking new studios. This is my first visit to the new RNIB studio, which I'm rather impressed by, actually.
Well, it's very good to hear that. And I think the writing is really good. When I was sort of listening to it and reading it, there's some lovely depictions of the sort of the tiny sort of sleigh and reindeer as they fall onto the lawn and how the reindeer move up onto the roof. And I think also the depiction of St. Nicholas or Father Christmas as he comes down the chimney. So, I mean, it's a wonderful writing, isn't it?
It's wonderful. And, you know, part of the whole business of Father Christmas and the chimney has managed to be an iconic element of the Christmas celebration, and it makes a good use of it in the poem. I like the fact they're all tiny. I don't think I'd really got to that without the poem. I think I thought Father Christmas was just the big fat man sitting in a sledge, you know, that somehow got onto the roof. But the fact that they're all tiny, and it makes more sense, although it doesn't completely explain how some of the toys he brings are large. But we won't be too scientific about it, I think.
I always thought that maybe the tiny sort of sleigh and reindeer and Father Christmas that landed on the lawn suddenly got bigger as they went up onto the roof. I don't know, because like you, I was thinking, well, how on earth is he putting all the sort of presents into the stockings and giving a nod to them as well? So, you know, it's interesting, isn't it?
It always celebrates the idea that the whole family hangs their stockings by the principal chimney piece in the house. Does anyone do that? I don't think anyone does that. I think we all have our own stockings at the end of the bed, don't we? But anyway, again, clearly there's a limit to the examination of the text that we should indulge in.
Julian, I wondered, what's Christmas like in the Fellows household? Are there any sort of special things that you do each year, any traditions and any possible books you might be reading?
Well, I think my family, like many, many families, have their own Christmas and our own ritual, which on the whole we stick to pretty tightly every year. And we arrange our presents and we have the name on the back of the chairs to whose presents these are. And then we have to go out and assemble in the hall and we sing Good King Wenceslas. The reason we sing Good King Wenceslas is because when I was a child, it was the only carol my father could remember the words to. So it was either Good King Wenceslas or nothing as far as we were concerned. But we do sing it and we walk round the house and eventually we stop and go off and open the presents. And really, the whole day is governed by such minutiae. And, you know, we have quite an easy lunch. And then but later we get dressed up and we have a huge dinner and all of those things, which every family must settle for itself as to whether they have a huge lunch at sort of 2 or 4 in the afternoon. And then perhaps television in the evening, which would be forbidden for us. The big television day is Boxing Day. So, I think everyone has their own way. I like that, actually.
And do you have any books that you might read at Christmas time to sort of, as I say, maybe escape to?
I don't know. I mean, I always rather hope to be given a book or two that I want to read. I am at the moment in Thomas Hardy's very, very early novel. I think his first novel published, which is Desperate Remedies. And I'm finding it much more interesting than I realized, and much more finished in a sense, much more sophisticated. And if I haven't finished reading that, I'll go straight on with it. But on the whole, I like to have two books on the go, one of which is a novel, usually in my case a 19th century novel, and the other is a factual book, generally a biography, a historical biography. And then that'll keep me going, really.
And as I said, you've been a long-time supporter of the RNIB and also one of our vice presidents for a number of years. What made you sort of first want to get involved in supporting the RNIB, and what does it mean to you being one of our vice presidents for a few years now?
Well, I'm very honoured to be a vice president, and I was taken by surprise with that, and I felt that it was a terrific path. But how I first got interested in the RNIB is like a lot of other people. I came across people whose sight was failing in my own family and in my parents' circle and so on. And I became interested, I think, because I was very aware of how dependent I was on sight and how much of my life was governed by sight. And the thought of being deprived of it or having it reduced was initially very frightening. But then, as a kind of logical step to that, I got interested in how you could live with it. And it seemed to me very attractive that one of the principal goals of the RNIB is the autonomy of people who are challenged with their sight, and more devices and habits and confidence, actually, apart from anything else, that you can provide for yourself. You can make a reasonably comfortable life. You can entertain yourself and everything. None of these things are forbidden you if you will just learn a different way or adopt a different kind of machine or whatever. And I felt that very strongly, that to strive for the autonomy of people, because, you know, being blind cuts you off from this and being deaf cuts you off from that. I mean, all of these things. But rather than surrender, which I think is a mistake generally, the RNIB is essentially a positive organization that believes in not surrendering and in making things better for people who are challenged. And so I just sort of drifted into its embrace, really. And then Melvyn Bragg had come to the end of a long stint of being head of Talking Books. So that, you know, came up and I got involved with that. The Talking Book is an antidote to loneliness for a lot of people. And that seems to me not sad, but a useful contribution and a useful addition to many lives. So all of it was, you know, gradual and exploratory, but very interesting. And I'm glad to see the organization thriving in its spanking new office, and it makes me happy.
And the RNIB Talking Books Library is so important for us all as blind and partially sighted people to be able to have access to books, you know, sort of to be able to listen to them and read them. And that's, you know, so important, isn't it?
It's very important. And I think it's very important that you should be in control of how much you're reading, how long, what you're reading. The one thing I do feel very strongly about the Talking Books Library is that they are not edited. They are not expurgated. They are not cut. They are the full book. And if you want to fast forward, that's your business. But it's not our business to tell you which bits to read and which bits we think you'll be better off without. I'm very much opposed to that. I think a lot of people don't know that a good deal of the books they buy are edited and are expurgated. And that's fine. I mean, I'm not fighting that. You don't necessarily want the whole thing, but you've got to have the option of the whole thing. And that is what the Talking Books Library gives you, which for me is important. I don't know if it is for everyone.
And obviously, having written many novels and screenplays like Gosford Park, and of course being behind the very successful award-winning Downton Abbey with the ITV series and the films as well, when you're writing, do you sort of think about how your words are going to be spoken, whether that's by an actor on the big or small screen or whether it's being narrated in an audio book? Do you sort of think about that when you're writing?
Yes, I think you do. I mean, I think you need sometimes to hear it, actually. And the first read-through, you know, when you make a movie or you make a television series, whatever, or a play, actually, it's all the same, you gather together for a read-through before rehearsals begin. And for many writers, that's the first time they've really heard it read aloud and disengaged from themselves. And that is always a big learning day. You know, and you scribble all over the text for the bits that don't work, or you go on about something too much, or, you know, this. Mind you, my wife is pretty tough in her note. This bit is very boring, she'll scribble. And we don't need this. We know it already, you know. And someone needs that. Every writer needs someone in their life who's going to do that. But it is an important part. I mean, of course, with drama, you are very interested in the actor who's going to play it, because that influences it totally. And, you know, now, because I'm as old as the hills, I'm usually also a producer, and so I have some say in who's going to play the parts and everything. But when I was starting out as a writer, I didn't have any position at all beyond that. I was a hired hand. And rather like Tinkerbell, you know, for a writer, it depends who believes in you. And if they don't, you've had it. And I remember those days. And I was lucky with some directors, Robert Altman, who did Gosford Park, which was my great lucky break. He was interested in what I felt about the different actors he was selecting. I don't say he was always influenced by what I said, but he did always ask. Whereas there are other directors who couldn't care less what you think. They, you know, it's their business. So it's a little bit of a struggle, but I would think probably in pretty well every career there is a parallel situation to that one that we all have to fight our way through. But it's certainly the player. I mean, I was very, very lucky, because Altman was something of an icon of the film industry at the time I worked with him. And he was also very much the king of Americana. And when he was making a British film, everyone knew there'd never be another. That if you were an English actor and you fancied being in a Robert Altman movie, this was the one, you know. It didn't matter whether you'd read it or not. So I was absolutely amazed as this extraordinary cast was assembled, all of whom knew how to add a dimension to the character they read on the page. And so that was an extraordinary, luxurious situation when it was the first film I'd written that got made. You know, I'd done a little bit of children's television and things, but I'd never written a feature film that had got made. So that was very spoiling. And I have, over the years, actually, been extremely fortunate in the actors who have agreed to do my stuff. You know, very seldom can I think of performances where I didn't quite agree with the casting. I would say almost never, really.
And I must mention Belgravia, which is now a sort of a mini-series, I think, on streaming platforms now. But I think initially it was available online as both text and audio. Was that something that you were sort of keen to happen to start off with, to have it available in audio?
Well, they came to me with the idea of releasing it once a week and having this audio version you could tune into, but also a printed version you could buy. But you could never buy more than that chapter. You have to then wait for the following week. And of course, this was a sort of modern version of how Dickens was published, or Thackeray, or George Eliot, or any of them. They were weekly episodes, and in the end, the publisher would bind them all together and publish it as a book in one or two volumes. But you had to wait for that, you know. You had to go through the whole business of getting it chapter by chapter. And for them, rather like for us with a film, there's a moment with a particular hit film when you start to realize you've got to get this film seen because people are talking about it. And if you leave it too long, you'll know too much. You've got to get down to the cinema straight away. And they had that. They had to get it read as it came out, because otherwise people would tell them what was happening in it. So, you know, those things are very similar, really. And it rather appealed to me to be releasing it in the same way as someone in 1858, you know. But of course, after it was done, then it was published as a novel. And that was that.
It's nice it's come onto the small screen or the big screen now as well, which is, I think, nice for everybody. Julian, are there any sort of plans for any writing or maybe another series or perhaps maybe the return of the Crawley family in 2024?
Well, you know, you never know. I mean, I wrote the last chapter of Downton so many times that I would hesitate to say that it was gone forever. But really, at the moment, what I'm doing is a series I make in America called The Gilded Age, which here is on Sky Atlantic. And that's about that rather extraordinary period in American history after the end of the Civil War and really leading up to the First World War, although in many ways it went on for a bit longer than that. But it was a sort of exploration of this explosion of wealth that happened after the Civil War. And these people, they weren't descended from Scottish gentry or the Dutch or British landowning family. You know, that was all the original settlers. These were brash new people who'd made their fortunes, and very great fortunes they were, and their socially ambitious wives who swept into New York and built palaces up and down Fifth Avenue and similar things in all the other major cities in America. And they created a new society, really. And I think in some senses they invented what became modern America. They really were in preparation for the 20th century, which came very soon after it began. And that was the century they dominated. I mean, the 20th century was largely lived according to American design. And I just got very interested in that. And now the second series is going out at the moment. And of course, there is a possibility, but not a certainty, of a third series. But with television writing, you really have to be prepared before it's a reality. Because otherwise, when the commission comes, you haven't got time to write the whole thing. So you have to take a chance. And I think, again, you know, there are plenty of careers where you have to spend a lot of time preparing something that may never happen. And that's just part of having a career. I think one must be philosophical about it and get on with it.
Well, Julian, thank you very much indeed for chatting with me here on RNIB Connect Radio and, of course, for recording A Night Before Christmas for us here at the RNIB. And I wish you and your family a really joyful and peaceful Christmas and New Year.
Oh, well, thank you. I've enjoyed it. Thank you for inviting me, and a very happy Christmas to you.